All right, so starting this week, we're going to get into basic fluid mechanics, which will be an adventure for all of us because I've never had a course or anything in this, so I've used it a little bit. So if any of you had any coursework in fluids?
Yeah, I did one class in last year undergrad.
By all means, let me know if I make any grievous errors. Anybody else? No. You be quiet. we can start really basic. We're just about fluids. We already know a little bit about fluids because we drink water. So just take a box of some fluid, some volume of a fluid. And if we know anything about fluids, we know this, that the mass within a volume is going to be given by integral over the volume times the density, and that the change of that mass in time is going to be given by, basically, if there's nothing flowing out of the box, this will not change. And so you can find out how much the mass is changing by doing an integral over the entire surface. Times the rate of flow out times dotted into the to a normal vector. So this is some sort of normal vector. So if you could calculate how much is flowing out of all the different surfaces of your volume, you know how much mass is leaving. Pretty straightforward. And so we can just take the time derivative of this equation, and that's just just go straight through because the integrals are commute. And so we can equate those and have this is a velocity. So we can use well-known theorems of vector calculus. Convert anytime you have a surface integral, you can always change it into a volume integral. This way. Then you can notice that this is a volume integral and it's equal to another volume integral. And so what that means is that the arguments are going to have to be equal to each other. So we can just rewrite this as a differential equation of a form that should be unsurprising, if you think about it. So this is the continuity equation. That is just, this is the equation for mass, the conservation. This makes sense that the change of density locally is going to always be offset by the flow of density out. The flow of mass out of the region. Okay, that makes sense. And just because we'll use it again in a moment, we can just go ahead and expand out this derivative and just rewrite this as and this is another form that will be often useful, basically because a lot of times in fluids, this is going to be zero. And there's an incompressible fluid. If that's zero, then this is the proper form. And we just call, by the way, this right here, just to give you some notation, this is going to be called J, or the flux, the mass flux. If I talk about flux of mass, that's what I'm going to be talking about. Basically, flux is always just some scalar quantity times the velocity. So, but that's not obviously the only thing that's going on. So we have mass. We also have force, right? So let's again take, then let's take another volume. And then take a little subvolume within that. And now by considering the subvolume, we can say, well, the fluid, we can guess what the fluid version of F equals ma is going to be. This would be rho times the acceleration will be equal to the force acting on the on our little element. And of course, because it's an element, not just an individual particle, the force will have to act on all around the edges, right? So it's going to be, again, one of these surface integrals times the force acting, use capital F for the force, acting on, again, that normal. And because the force is in, where it's normal is outwardly directed, there's the minus sign. And again, we can convert this to a volume integral. And if we just no, this is a, oh, sorry, this is no, I'm not connected. Sorry, this is a vector, the acceleration vector. This force is just a scalar. This will be the scalar force, otherwise known as the pressure. And then the gradient of the pressure integrated over the volume will give you the acceleration of the particle. Okay? And so really, I should be writing force equal to pressure. This will be the definition of pressure that we'll be using. But okay, so this seems to be, we seem like we're already done, but we're not quite, because there's two other things that can happen, right? So one is that the change in the velocity of this box is really a function of both the location and time, right? That's right. So, and also, well, it's not really, this box isn't moving. This is an important point. If you're one of your homework problems, we'll deal with this. Is that there's basically two ways to conceive of fluids. One is where you have to keep static boxes and let the fluid move through them. And the other way is to have the box move with the fluid. And they're equivalent. We're going to be working where the box is fixed, and we're going to think about the fluid moving through the box. So this, in this case, the box is fixed. And so this change of the velocity within this box in time is really decomposed in two parts. One is just how much just the purely time rate of change. But there's also a component that has to do with let me just write this slightly differently. So if we just think about the differential of that velocity, there's going to be two components. There's the change with respect to time, dt, and there's also dr, the change with respect to r, right? Where r is just the location. So as you move this box around, if you move around different places, the velocity can be different. For instance, if you have like some kind of a flow going through the middle, and the velocity of the fluid would be high there, but then it's static around the sides, then you want to be able to capture the idea that there's parts of the fluid that have a velocity or can be accelerating, and there's other parts that don't, right? And so basically, then if you just think about this, you just go ahead and sort of divide through by t, dt, and you get that the total time derivative of the velocity, the total acceleration, is two parts, a time part plus a dr dt part, which is again just v times a gradient. Right? So this is just v. So velocity enters twice. The change of the velocity along integrated or along the direction of the velocity is the full rate of change. Velocity, okay? Does that make sense? A little bit painfully derived, but there you go. And so that means that you can rewrite this equation up here. In the following way. That partial v over partial t over the whole, now if we just go ahead and think about this being over that whole volume, will be equal to, and let's go ahead and switch t over rho, so that the change of the velocity for a volume of fluid in space and time is given by minus the gradient of the pressure divided by the density. Okay, so this is the generalized, this is known as Euler's equation. Okay, does this make sense so far? Probably fairly dull. But and there's one more thing that you can add here, is that I talked about, I spoke of the local forces acting right around the edges of the box. But you can also imagine that, you know, this is a crate of fluid sitting on the surface of the Earth, that you can have another sort of external force acting here, right? And that's something like the gravitational field, or any external force. So to be general, you should be able to realize that if you add extra force terms on the right-hand side, local forces will, you can encode and say it with pressure, and then extra forces will be, right? That's two of our basic fluid equations. And then just for the moment, we're going to, just to complete sort of the basic equations of fluid mechanics. And we're going to come back and derive these again in just a moment in more general language. But I want to give the idea first. The last is to say, OK, what if to complete the set, we need one more, or at least another equation. That would be equation for the entropy of the fluid. So fluids are thermodynamic objects. But if you just say that the entropy of the fluid is not changing in time, then you have an entropy. And you can basically use the lessons from before to write an entropy flux equation that looks very, very similar to what we already have. And just if you rewrite this as again dst plus d dot grad f equals 0, then you're almost there. It turns out that it's nice to go ahead and work with instead of just straight f, to like go ahead and look at what if you go ahead and weight rho by the density, by so basically take this equation and then weight these fluid elements by S and use the fact that S isn't changing in time to go ahead and derive an equation for how the entropy density evolves, then turns out not to be that hard, and it's just this evolves, and then anyway, the point is, it'd be nice to have, okay, so equation of this form. So, right, so you have two parts. So you just go ahead and put in rho s, this part, and then just see what that gives you. So and then plus, and you get the v dot div for less, or s, e, plus, and then this, but this term again can be rewritten as v dot of rho s times v dot rho plus rho v dot grad s, right? So then we can break this into two parts. S times d rho dt plus v rho plus rho times ds dt plus v dot. Right? Anyway, and so the point is that you know this part, you already know this part zero, which tells you that you know that this part zero from up here, which means that this original equation was actually equal to zero. You probably could have guessed, but it's not. So turns out you can weight the map, and like your continuity equation can be weighted by other scalar things. And as long as those are conserved, then you can get the other continuity equations for the conservation of any such quantity. This is entropy, the most important one, but if you came up with something else you wanted, you could do that. Now, the last of the basic fluid mechanics equation that we're deriving is basically to go back to Euler's equation. And this, as we're specializing more and more here. And so right now we have the total derivative of S with respect to time is zero, but we haven't restricted that. We've seen that the entropy can flow around in the fluid. Now, if we really take S just to be constant, so the entropy is just dead constant, same everywhere and all time, then we can use our knowledge of thermodynamics to rewrite pressure in terms of the heat function for a fluid. This is just for later reference. Carry my notes with me so that I don't make silly mistakes. But, But we're here. For next, this and this replacement we'll be making throughout the day today. We can rewrite one over the density as a specific volume. Just convenient purpose. You've probably seen this before. Chemistry classes. Anyway, but because this is true, this is very suggestive. We have dw equals pp over rho. Of course, then we previously had grad p over rho, right? So that combination is clearly special. And what you can do is rewrite Euler's equation using this. Where W is now is a scalar quantity. And so if, since it's a scalar quantity, what we can actually simplify it one more step by taking a curl. And you may be familiar from the sort of manipulations you did in electromagnetism. But if you recall the vector identity, probably don't. I didn't recall the vector identity. But I started thinking about these lecture notes. That the vector curl, vector cross curl of a vector is equal to half the gradient of the vector squared minus the vector dotted with gradient of a vector. So this is useful because this allows us to rewrite v dot grad v as a sum of the gradient v squared minus this combination. And then, right? Yeah, so we haven't taken the curl yet, but we just recall that vector identity. Then you rewrite this as in that exact way. I know this is really dry. I promise that next week will be more interesting, but I've got to take you through this. And now we basically see that now we have two scalar quantities in this equation. Now we're getting to the thing I promised you a moment ago. If you remember that the curl or the gradient of a scalar, of any scalar, is always zero. And so turns out to be nice just to go ahead and take the curl of this whole thing. And then the time rate of change of the curl of V drops out this term, when these terms are, in fact, scalars, which they often are. And then we get the curl of V cross the curl of V. This like the most marvelous vector equation you can possibly imagine. And this governs the behavior of velocities without any reference to the fluid, underlying fluid. But you can simplify this by, because people don't like writing that many times curl of V. You just write this is known as the vorticity of the fluid. So basically what this tells you is that the vorticity of the fluid is given by this, actually. Yeah. By this formula. So I guess this is like. Anyway, so that's a equation that turns out to be useful. I'm not sure how much we're going to use it in the course, but I've always liked the vorticity equation. How many different cross products can you possibly work into a single equation? All right, so any questions so far? So this is, you now know everything there is to know about fluid mechanics. You can go off and. That is because it's synergy. Sorry, yeah. This is the green. Sorry. This is just I'm just math. I'm not gonna have time. I thought about reviewing thermodynamics today, but then I realized that that'd be too long. So the point here was just that you can just go ahead and get that into a form that was manifestly. Many fluids that are just sort of like not undergoing radical changes, like the ones that are they're not being heated radically, they're just sort of like flowing around. If the entropy, I can't tell you exhaustively, but a lot of the time, this is true. If the fluids are, I'm sorry. A fluid is flowing under. Yeah. In general, yeah. Is that right? It depends somewhat on what's going on. But a lot of times, I mean, just for the basic mechanics of fluid flow, this is all. I haven't introduced any viscosity here yet, but to be true, a lot of the time, though, not all the time. I don't know. I'm not super confident on my fluid mechanics, but it's frequently you can frequently make these approximations, and it's a good thing too because otherwise you can't solve the equation. You can't even solve them in this case always, but. So any other questions? No? All right. So now we're going to start again back here on board one. I'm going to do this from a different perspective. I'm going to put back in all the things that we left out to do with. But this is a sort of a manifestly fluid kind of way where we sort of used our intuition about fluids we already have and derive some basic properties that made a lot of intuitive sense, right? I don't know, maybe it didn't make intuitive sense, but insofar as differential equations make intuitive sense, these are pretty basic. I mean, like, we had conservation of energy, we have acceleration equals force divided by mass, we have the change of some scalar quantity is given by the gradient of that scalar quantity. We have the vorticity, the change of vorticity in time given by something about the curl of the fluid changing in time. These are things that you can sort of like, you can think about just sort of like observing in the real world, right? But if we go back to our picture, our original picture of what a fluid is, then a fluid is really a collection of molecules, right? That obey certain properties. And so we already started talking about this, that the phase space occupied by a set of molecules here is some distribution function. It's a function of P, X, and T. Your P is now, I'm going to call it K. I'm going to call K is the momentum. And X is position. T is time times some differential volume. Okay? And so if we want to look, so now we want to think about the properties of this distribution function. And this is actually going to end up being just like fluid, because this distribution function tells you sort of how much of the fluid is there and what that fluid is doing in that location. Because it's a function of all of these things, you can think of this mapping into all of these fluid areas. You'll see eventually. And so if we just think about, again, now it would take the differential of f. So what? How can f change? Say f can change with time, right? F can change with space. And f can change with momentum, right? Pretty fun. And if we write that, if we remember that dx dt is velocity, and that dp dk dt is equal to the force, which we're going to write as a gradient of some potential, just to keep the number of like fundamental the number of vectorial quantities to a minimum. Then we can rewrite this as df dt plus xi v di minus df dk I grad I of some potential. And that's going to be equal to basically, all right, so that, well, I'm not going to make that equal to anything just yet. Okay, so what that means is that the total change, d, that's perfect. No, yeah, there's dt's. So we can go ahead and take out the d, divide by the dt's, and see the total change in f time is given by a sum of three terms, which again have nice intuitive interpretations. That the change of the distribution, the properties of the particles in the box at a given time are all undergoing all kinds of different changes. One is just the total change of that distribution as time goes on. One is the gradient as those particles flow. And then the change in the, like, the energy or the momentum in those particles as they're acted on by force. Okay? Does that make sense? Now, so then you may ask, so what generates, so now you can ask yourself, what generates these kinds of changes? And the simple answer is that one thing that we've already discussed is that what changes these things is that we can now go back. The intuition we gain sort of in a reverse way of, you remember the when we were talking about the stars going by each other? And so the cumulative long-range forces. Now, here we're thinking about molecules that have no long-range forces with respect to each other. These are uncharged molecules in the fluid. And so the stars that went by each other in our galactic dynamics studies mainly interacted through these long-range forces, but there's also the short-range forces that we neglect, right? So if you have no long-range forces, then the short-range forces become the only game in town. And short-range forces are, in fact, called collisions, right? We all know we pay our auto insurance, collisions cause problems. Okay. Anyway. Stupid joke. Anyway, I just spent two weeks ago renegotiating my auto insurance. Nightmare. Anyway, and for collisions, we know something about collisions. We physicists know something about collisions. So collisions basically happen. And we, yeah, I particularly know about collisions because we have not one, but two pool tables. One's a sniffer table, but who knows the difference? Anyway, so a collision happens whenever you just, going ahead and just assuming that we have one stationary molecule with a momentum p, or not stationary, but a let's just take it as stationary and call this momentum p1. And then we have some other molecule use k. K, k1. So this particle with momentum k1 slams in the particle with momentum k2. And afterwards, what happens? K2, k1 has some new momentum, k1 prime. And k2 has some new momentum, k prime, right? And we know that momentum for elastic collisions will be conserved. And believe me, we'll be happy to just keep these as elastic for the moment. But actually, we're going to calculate all of these, this collision term, and then we're going to try to set it to zero. But it's important to think about what goes into collision terms in general, because they're not always so easily set to zero. Anyway, and so from a phase space perspective, which is what we're looking at here, phase this mini this. Good morning. This multi-dimensional phase space perspective, you're thinking about density and how all of these quantities can be changed by these phenomena. And so basically, there's two things that can happen. Is the change I don't even know what to call it, but Plodmonoman for some reason selects R as a variable. I don't know why, but for want of another better variable, I'll do that. And basically, the change in these two volumes has two parts. A change of particles going out of that volume with respect to as time goes on. That is like a collision that takes something that's in this little space here. And you can think of this as if you're good at visualizations in higher dimensions, you can think of this as a six-dimensional cube, because it's really what it is, right? Because there's three spatial dimensions, but there's also three momentum direct dimensions. So it's really sort of x plus or minus little displacement in x, and also some momentum plus or minus little displacement in momentum. And so you can think about leaving this region, like if you're in your Toyota and a Mack truck hits you, then you're no longer in the vicinity of the momentum that you were previously occupying, probably. Anyway, and so how many particles are in this region is going to be changed by two things. One's the interactions that kick things out, and there's other interactions with other particles that are not in your neighborhood. They kick them into your neighborhood, so they have to be nearby. So they're nearby particles that like get bumped by other particles, so they come into your little region, right? Maybe this means region. I really don't know. Does anybody know why R is used? Me either. Anyway, doesn't matter. And so basically, the rate at which these things happen is going to be governed by a few things. One is sort of is the product of the densities. So for kicking out, you basically have to have a density in the two of the two different states coming in. Keep switching. My notes are written in terms of p. So as I switch back and forth, that's why. I just want to apologize for that. So you have the phase space near k. The phase space near K1. And obviously, these interactions are only going to happen if there's particles that possess these momentum, right? And so if F of K is zero, that is, if K were like some number like 7, and in your gas there's no molecules that have momentum equal to 7, then the rate at which particles with momentum 7 are changing your distribution is zero, because there's no density, right? And this is basic, but I just want to emphasize that these things do make sense. I'm not making just these formulas don't just come out of the ether, which is the sense that I know that I at least had sometimes whenever I was a student, and even now sometimes I feel that way. But it's good to always remind yourself that if the equation doesn't make sense, then you probably you're either very confused or it's been written in a confusing way. But you should always try to make your equations make sense, at least to you, once in a while. Anyway, so these things, and then some function, which I'm going to call a scattering cross-section, sigma, is not, the form of this is going to not be very important. Which basically tells the rate at which incoming particles with momenta k and k1 get turned into outgoing particles with momenta k1 and k prime. Or just the likelihood of that particular thing happening. It would be, sometimes it, and then the moment, so this is a momentum transfer, so this, we're talking about momentum transfer. And so another thing that's going to enter is the difference of the velocities of the particles. They're never going to hit, they don't have different velocities. Their velocities are identical, they're never going to strike each other. And then they're only going to hit each other during the same time. So this is going to be a collision that happens uniquely at a unique location. Because again, this is the whole assumption, this is a collision at a not long difference. Okay? And so then, similarly, the integral over the derivative with respect to all the same things but primed everywhere. Sorry, did you do that? But get tired of writing. Anyway, so this is going to be the same, basically the same idea, only this time it'll be everywhere in the opposite direction. So basically, all of these things with k primes replacing k's and vice versa. This is supposed to be absolute values, by the way, just because direction doesn't matter. The direction is all taken care of here. This is just the overall transfer. And I'm also assuming that all of these particles have the same mass implicitly. So the momentum transfer is always just proportional to the change, the difference in velocity, not different masses. And you can sort of start to see how you would generalize all this, right? If you needed to go through that agony, and you sort of had to, like, different populations of different kinds of molecules, and you had to start summing them up. Maybe you can visualize that. Maybe you can't. I don't know. Don't worry about it. Okay. So those are your two collision equations. And then this is making sense so far, by the way. I know I haven't done that much yet. The lesson. Right. In some sense, yeah. This is supposed to represent sort of like the differential rate of at which particles are either going out of or into this volume.
So it's like the possibility to escape from this region.
Right. This anything else?
Yes.
Or actually into this other to
or
this
to
other
particular
yeah to that other particular region.
So and they should be.
And they're not always the same. They're not necessarily the same. But it will turn out that in the cases we're interested in, they are the same. That's the point.
Is it because we're keeping the Gini constant?
Not, well, no.
Just think that if you're keeping the Gini constant, then the rate of, if you're in the local,
right, so that's going to be called local thermal. It's actually, it's called thermal equilibrium. So it's a slightly different all right. Anyway, but yeah, so the point is that in cases of interest, this will be, you can imagine, I mean, this is always true, right? I mean, if you have like an air cannon blowing into a room, this will still govern what's going on. It's not going to be, this is going to be a very, all of these will be rapidly changing. Right, so you, or if you have a fire underneath, you know, vaporizing, it'll still be, you can still describe it in a sort of language. And those will be situations that are not very simple. And that's the beauty of using this very general language, is you can capture lots of different things. But then we're going to very quickly specialize to a case where it doesn't really, none of this matters. But it's important, I think, to see this, because this is known as the Boltzmann equation, Boltzmann transport equation. And so the point is that this is one of the fundamental equations of sort of behavior of fluids of any kind. It is just how phase space changes in time. Maybe something that recurs again and again. We implicitly and secretly discussed this already in the case of galaxies, because we were talking about like the thermalizing of galaxies through these gravitational interactions. And so secretly we were doing this with a long range force, but we didn't do it explicitly. Now it's just useful to go through it explicitly. It'll be a little bit clearer. I don't want you to think too much about the name of the left-hand side. But the point is that these things, we're going to integrate this over this, and it's going to be basically the right-hand side of this equation. Some collisions. The rate of change will be given by these kinds of collisions. And so the next assumption we make is that follows on from this assumption of elastic collisions, which is that these two sigma functions of k goes to k prime, and it's going to be the same k and k prime is going to be equal to the opposite direction, which should make sense, right? I mean, you shouldn't have some kind of asymmetry. Here. And so this is so sigma is really just going to be a function of the relative angles of the collision. So the final momentum direction will be just depend on the incoming momentum direction. And also following from this, that the conservation of momentum in these collisions means that the three-dimensional phase space volume in momentum space, the second cube around dk, is actually going to not change either. So that the collisions from all of the collisions that are allowed to happen from k1 and k and k1 are going to be mapped exactly into a volume of the same size of k1 prime and k. So that is, you only can, there's only a, if you have this many states, this many initial momentum states, they can only go into the same number of final states. You can't access a whole new set of states here. So you can think about, like, if the new states were smaller, that'd be because it would be dissipation happening, right? But you'd be shrinking all of the amount of states possible, reachable. And if you were like heating up the system, then this would be expanding the number of states possible. Anyway, and so the point is then that the collision term of a function of f is going to be given by this volume times an integral over the, so we're basically going to take this dr in minus dr out. So this will be the total amount of particle, like the number of particles coming in minus particles going out will be the flux, right, into our finite space volume. It'll be times the volume, and then we'll integrate this whole thing over both the, over this full 12 dimensional volume. I'm not gonna be that hard to give delta function. Yes, this is just momentum conservation. I know this stuff is pretty dry today. I apologize. But anyway, and so okay. So we integrate over x. We get one factor of angles. We have a relative factor of angles left, and it's really going to be take care of this too. This is going to be the relative. There's only relative angles matters. All the integral over volume is handled. The two different ones. So the integral over momentum simplifies because we can make it replace. And because of the delta functions, all of these. So the volume, the delta functions take care of the volume integration, and then the conservation of momentum equalizes the momentum integration. So we just have an integral over. And so if we want to find out sort of what happens at k, for the we have the area around volume around k times integration over all the different possible k1s. So if we have k1 being the, oops, I did that back. Anyway, it doesn't really matter, but we have k1 here. So if k1's the are sort of the state we're considering, we have integrate over all of the different possible other particles coming in. And so the key here is that the only thing that's really different between these is that in this term we have the momentum, the distribution functions evaluated at the pre-collision momenta, and these have the distribution functions evaluated at the post-collision momenta. And so the rate in is versus the rate out. It's just going to be sort of like the volume, the density of the two states that make it, you know, make things come into the state we're considering, minus the density of things leaving. There, does that make sense? Right, probability of a collision taking a particular particle at a particular momentum, in either into or out of the phase space, the little volume d3x, d3k that we're considering. Okay, and so, all right, so now, so basically now we can call this our collision term. And so we're going to integrate out k. And so this will just be a function of k1. And so we just call that our collision term. And we'll come back to that in a second. We're basically going to just make it zero eventually. But now we can start actually rederiving our fluid, some of our fluid equations using this language. So basically, we see that So let's just rewrite this now. And So we rewrite this now as df ut plus partial x I of the I half minus partial k I of grad I u f collision. Where I've implicitly assumed here that I can move these gradients and the velocity into the derivative by assuming basically that they don't depend on these two things. I'm just going to assume that for now. Simplify these equations. So then what we can do is just start now. I'm going to start integrating these in simple cases. The first way to integrate it is just to basically take the mass of the particle times the left hand side, integrate over all momenta, and that'll be equal to the integral of the right-hand side times the mass. Turns out this right-hand side is always zero. Once you integrate over all momenta, then like the total number of, since the total number of particles is conserved, the collisions of any particle going to any particle is no different, right? You can only have a relative rate of like from one initial state to another final state. But the initial state is everything, and the final state is everything. And the rate of everything to everything is always the same as the rate of everything going back to everything else, right? So this, if I integrate this over both all k and all k1, then the difference will go away. And so, but the point is the integral over, we have three terms in the integral over k. And the point is that so we basically have two integrals to do. One is the integral of fx dt over all xkt over all k. And this is just the number density, right? Because once we take out the momentum, then we just have the total number of particles living in a region near x at time t. And so this is just the number density at t. And so the m times n, just rho, right? Rho is just the density of the fluid. Similarly, the integral over vi times f of x, k, t, t3, right? We're just gonna define this to be capital V by times n, where we've this is just the definition of capital I VI, which is the sum is this integral over all the different momenta. And then basically what we have is looking at our initial equation up here. The Boltzmann equation. So using these replacements, we have partial rho, partial t. Oh yeah, and then the integral over partial ki of all the stuff, which is k, just zero. It's just the integral over the gradient. Maybe. Zilch. And so this is going to basically be the change of rho over t plus So, lo and behold, we've rederived the continuity equation from fundamental concentration. So, I'm sure it's reassuring to see that I'm coming back nice and good. And so, basically, then what you do is that you keep going. So that time I multiplied everything times mass, and so then the next thing to do is just to go ahead and take everything and multiply times the momentum in each particle, the mass times the velocity. Everything's non-relativistic. And so as you can even start to see what's going to the pattern here. So I multiply by mass and I get the conservation of energy. And so if I multiply by momentum, then I'm going to find out what the conservation of momentum looks like. Indeed, that's exactly what you get. So now, if I multiply through mvj times the left-hand side, again, the right-hand side is always going to vanish when you do this integral overall. Okay. And this is going to be equal to three terms. So the first term is, again, partial respect to t of m vj f of x k t v3 k. We already did this, right? This is just t of vj, capital Vj times rho. And then we have the second term. Now it's going to look a little complicated. It's going to be the gradient I of an integral of m dI dj f of x k t d 3 k. And this is where you learn one of your most handy physicist tricks, which is that when you have something that looks really complicated, you don't actually do anything with it because you can't. You just, much like in this case, you just give it a new name. Just call it T I of J. For those of you who know gravity will recognize this is going to be the stress, this is going to be called the stress tensor. This is where the gravitational stress tensor gets its name. This one definitely preceded general relativity. And now the third term now won't vanish because it's not just a single integral over. So I have an integral with respect to derivative with respect to ki. And then we'll have an integral over partial u partial xi f of xk. And then now a new I bj. But mvj. But we can rewrite mvj as k. And then we notice that since we're taking a derivative with respect to k, this isn't going to depend on k. This does, but we're not going to worry about the gradient of it. We're going to integrate over it. So basically what you're going to see here, this is going to be 0 unless I and j are the same, right? So that the derivative of k, this is ki. I know these are probably a little bit hard to read. I'm trying to say them out loud. The jth component and the ith component are going to vanish unless the I and j are the same. So this would be a delta function. And anyway, so this just integrates up to be partial u of x. And then this is going to end up being an integral over rho. I mean, not an integral over f times mass, because the x just goes away. Okay. Goes away. And so, we have our equation of momentum conservation. which is just 1 plus 2 minus 3 equals 0. Because remember that this is a gradient. So there's this extra minus sign we're carrying around. And that's just rho. Right, and so I see that now this is a vector equation, right? Because it's one free index j is going to be carried through all three equations. And so this is now the conservation of momentum, which is if you look at it, is really going to be the same as that pressure as Euler's equation that we derived earlier, in the case where you can get Euler's equation from them, basically by just think about pulling out the rho part here. Anyway, it works out. Anyway, in the case of simple stress tensors, but we're going to come back to the stress tensor question later. Last but not least, you can do the same thing times energy, where you do, again, that's getting a little repetitive. You use energy, which is just basically e squared over. All right, k squared over times the left hand side. Okay. Then again, you're starting to, I'm sure, see the pattern here that. So here I'm just doing this. Go ahead and finish producing the notation. So the first term will be this dt, and this we call energy E, so epsilon. F. Okay, and for some reason in Padmanabhan, he likes to. Rather than using just E, he likes to just sort of call it, what he likes to call this is something called the average of N E dash, where N is basically rho over M. The integral over f x k t. Okay, the number, total number seems to be. And then e bar is equal to 1 over n epsilon. And so it's useful to know these different notations. It doesn't really matter. This is so by defining this, that you get this is the average energy per particle. And then so the average energy overall is the average energy per particle times the net particle density. So then you just call that the overall energy density.
So
yes.
This whole E is just the energy?
Yeah, so E, energy, density. And so it's the momentum. It's the, basically, well, yeah, it's sort of k squared over. And I mean, the thing is, so it's the energy per particle, really. But the average of it is the energy density, averaging over this way. The point here is that I really want to emphasize, not so much all of these things, so it's important to know these names, is that basically what you do is this f function is a helper function that lets you get these large scale kind of these like density and pressure. Stress tensor and flux, and it's just you integrate fundamental quantities using this distribution function to get macroscopic quantities. And so that's the process. I mean, that's that really is, I mean, the microscopic to macroscopic transition is basically mediated through this distribution, which is super important in a lot of different things. I mean, this is basically large scale quantum mechanics. This just has to do with like taking this distribution function and making it really a quantum mechanical one, and then looking. This basic process comes up again and again and again in physics. This is the, sort of the original case. So it's actually really one thing that I appreciate now more than I ever than did before is that the way that our physics education often goes now, we learn things like general relativity and quantum mechanics before you learn really like hardcore mechanics and like fluid mechanics. And so like for me, it's sort of like I see the stress tensor come out of these equations, like, oh yeah, it's like the general relativity stress energy tensor. But this is really why they call it that. In the same way, a lot of these distribution functions and things you learn about in like quantum mechanics or whatever, and then but this is why a lot of the reason why for the terminology we use comes out of this like 19th and 18th century physics. So it's kind of nice to see it in its classical setting. At least I think it's neat. Anyway, but so basically the last few things we have to do are so the second term is now this is the gradient part. So you're all old hands. At this point by now, if you've been writing down all of what I've been writing. And so we just call this now QI, which is the I forget what it's called, but that's okay. Anyway, it's just some energy. This is some energy flux vector. Yeah, because right, this is like an energy flux. And last but not least, in the I've been moving. I hope that I haven't confused anyone too much by moving back and forth between component and vector notation. Just I find it easier to write these things out in component. And so these components are always going to be matching when it's supposed to be divergences. And then they will not match when it's supposed to be gradient. So just whether you end up with free components or not. Everyone's familiar with that, isn't you? If you're not, just let me know later. Anyway, and so this is just going to all basically here that this you're going to have this this derivative is going to be acting on. So since E is k squared of m, derivative of E over k, so we're just going to give you really two. Anyway, so this is a k over 2m. And then the real. And so now you'll get really. This is just vi over. The energy is equal to k squared over 2m. Derivative of the energy with respect to the momentum, given by the momentum divided by m, which is just the velocity, right? And so this is just all going to end up being vi. So again, you just sum these three. So you just one again, 1 + 2 - 3 gives you equals 0. Here's your third equation. 1 + 2 - 3 is always 0. I guess that's actually a kind of a nice way to remember it, isn't it? Yes, yeah. Just do them in the right order. You'll see early. Okay. So this is again, and so this will be, once you sum these up, this will be the conservation of energy. This is, again, weighted distribution function by energy. If you're familiar with statistics, then this is just taking moments of the equation. Just like any, this is just like statistical distribution. So all connects, all makes sense. So the last, maybe not the last thing, we have one more thing to do, and then we have three more things today. I know that I told you this is going to be sort of a dull day. Y'all can decide if you want to take an early break and sort of rest, or if you want to go all the way till noon and then have a shorter time after lunch. Should we just keep going? You need a coffee
I prefer
break?
To go on till noon.
Yeah, I prefer that too. But
yeah. Right.
So, all right, so we'll press on. All right, so this is just general equations. So you can see this is basically, you can make mappings between fluid quantities and microscopic quantities in this way. The last thing we have to deal with, though, is that we'd like to know what happens when that, how we can guarantee, basically, that this collision term is always just an event. Like, what properties, so the question is, what forms of F of KT? How do you spell guarantee? Guarantee that collision term of F vanishes. Be the simplest. And basically, I'll just give you the answer that. The answer is that whenever f of k, this has the following form. When it's exponential, it'll look very familiar if you know anything about this. Some number mu over t minus mass of the particles divided by t times same t times the velocity minus the particle velocity minus the bulk velocity. Or, if you like, this is the chemical potential, which is you'll later know as the energy cost of creating or destroying a particle within a distribution minus k minus. So basically, the reason why this makes the collision term vanish is because, remember, the collision term basically depended on this combination. Right? So, didn't see in one, minus in the other. So you just plug this in. And what you find is essentially that, and what you do is you plug this in, and then you, which I wrote out in my notes, but it's a little excruciating. The point is you plug it in, though, and you use the fact that basically for collisions, you know, the conservation of momentum tells you that k plus k1 squared is always going to be equal to k prime plus k1 prime squared, right? For elastic collision, it's just the conservation of energy, really. And so by using this fact, essentially the you can see, right, that if you multiply these terms to each other, then you'll get things that look like k and k1 squared, and then you'll have minus something with a similar exponential structure. If you use this equation, then you just see that you essentially get something with e to the argument minus e to the same argument. And then there's an overall factor of u over t. and that's zero. And so the point is that by using this form where the distribution function depends on some function of temperature times something that depends on explicitly the kinetic energy divided by the temperature, by the conservation of that, by the conservation of kinetic energy for these kind of collisions, then the collisions function vanishes. So this is, again, this gets back to what you were saying to make this. That the kind of collisions for this where this doesn't matter are the kind where the kinetic energy is. So that if you can start thinking about it, right? So if this were not true, if the kinetic energy were not conserved, what would that be? That would be inelastic collision. That is collisions that after the collision happens, you've lost kinetic energy into usually heat, right? So you're heating up. So that's the case where this would no longer be, right? Does that make sense? Yeah. I think it's just an example. Obviously, you can probably take other forms. This is an example, the most important example. You can probably dream up another form. It'd be worth thinking about. It probably is. But it may not be, actually, but I'm not sure. I mean, it's just anything that satisfies this equation, right? So anything that solution. Maybe this is a general solution to that equation. I'm not really sure. If you want to think about it, welcome to do that. Bonus problem. So then, whenever this happens, this is called, and you can start to see this by the fact that I've started introducing this temperature here. I'm not going to say too much about that yet. But what this situation is called, or the left-hand side, the Boltzmann equation. Is, you know, non-trivial. But right-hand side vanishes. This is known as local thermal. And this is the only time whenever we can have a really good sense for what a temperature is. And that is the temperature that allows us to vanish, or this number that allows us to vanish, or that just allows us to define a temperature. So it's sort of a mutually reinforcing thing that we have a well-defined sense of temperature when this is. And so local you can almost always, in astrophysical situation, assume local thermal equilibrium. So not all the time. Certainly like in stars. Because the point is that it doesn't have to be global thermal equilibrium. All you need is just in a patch of the fluid where this equation holds. And you have a well-defined sense of temperature there. It's the local the temperature can change, but locally the temperature is multiple. This is one of the things you have to violate to get interesting phenomena happen. Because you can see that there's not really much, you can't do much to shake the left-hand side of this equation. So if there's anything, if you can prove that the left-hand side of this equation forbids anything, there's not much you can do to the left-hand side to change that. So the right-hand side is what you have to change. But to do that, you have to break this local thermal equilibrium requirement. A case that comes up in cosmology is known as this baryogenesis. Whenever in the early universe, the fact that matter and antimatter were both present and then annihilated, and we have more matter than antimatter. There has to be a violation of local thermal equilibrium for that to occur. But it's sort of hard to get in general. Anyway, so when this is true, We can do something with this stress term, this stress tensor that I wrote down. So it turns out. And so let's just recall what how it's defined. It's basically m times m times the average of vi times, right? Where these brackets just mean of star, it's just integral star f. Right? So what this turns something is, and the point here is that you take out the momentum dependence, but you leave both the x and t dependence. So it keeps this as a local quantity, but one that have the whole energy distribution function or momentum distribution function taken out, the momentum part. And so by using what we learned from above, we can rewrite this as always the average of some vi prime plus the bulk flow of the fluid as vj prime plus the bulk flow of the fluid. And the average of the bulk flow is always going to be, the local average of the bulk flow is just, the bulk flow is just some internal number. So this is just going to be mn times vi, okay, bulk flow plus m times n times the deviation from that bulk flow. Okay, so we've rewritten the local velocity as the bulk flow plus, if you want to be astronomical, the peculiar velocity of the fluid near that bulk flow. And if we assume in the preferred direction, in space, for these deviations from the bulk flow. So we've assumed that by taking out the bulk flow, we've taken out any overall variation in the space. So if the fluid's all flowing this way, there's nothing else special going on. What that means is that the average over VI, I'm going to call this delta, because it's, you don't have to change your notes, but right. Delta VI, delta VJ, is going to be equal to third times delta V, some delta V squared, j plus the off dike. Right, so this is sort of the trace, and then we just take, so this is the trace part, and this is the off diagonal part of some of this. So this will be some 3x3 vector describing the correlations between VI and VJ, right? So the point is that the average, then the x part and the y parts won't be correlated. And so that the average, and since these can be both positive and negative, the average over x and y directions, these will all be zero. So we'll just end up with the sum over the overall three. And so then the one in any direction squared. So then the average of any I, j, or k is going to be given by 1/3 of the squared, sum of the squared. Okay? And then we can use something else we know about. Fluids. I'm just going to drop this in from space. And then where this is equal to 3/2 times kt, This is the definition. I guess we can, in some sense, define this as the temperature using this. And so if we replace then delta V squared with T, then we have the 1/3 delta V squared, which is what appears here, can be equal to T divided by mass. But if you remember, and then if we just assume again now that this is an ideal gas, one for which PV and T, then this is just P over N. So that now we can just go ahead and write Tij. The stress tensor has two. I'll have two components. I'll have M times N times bulk flow times the bulk flow plus M times N times this thing, right? But this thing is equal to 1/3 delta V squared, but 1/3 average of delta V squared is equal to P over NM. So P over NM delta IJ. The enzymes cancel so that the stress tensor has the general form of the pressure times the delta function. So the diagonal part of this is the is pressure, and then the off diagonal parts all come from the bulk flow. And that's anisotropic part of the stress. Whenever that doesn't vanish. All right. And so you can do a similar process on your homework for finding out. Same process. Find that energy flux. Local thermal is one of the problems in Fun Monobond. Okay. Did that make sense? This just that you can use this, you have to sort of, I didn't really fully explain every step here, but the point is that you can use this idea of local thermal equilibrium to go ahead and localize things and then use properties near points, like use an ideal gas near a point, let you trade velocity, deviations from velocity to temperature, and use temperature to move pressure, and let you write something that complicated, like the stress sensor in terms of simpler quantities that look reasonable. Okay? Right. A little bit more time before lunch, and so I'm going to stick with the stress tensor and talk about viscosity. Any other questions? That's right. How can we?
I mean, why we derive more general results?
Well, you're wondering why we didn't do something more general?
I mean, like, is it a magic thing? Or?
Well, there's nothing. There's nothing magic. This is. I mean, most of the time, this is going to be true. Anytime you're in local thermal equilibrium. This is and an ideal gas. But the times whenever you're not with an ideal gas and local thermal equilibrium are going to be relatively small. Well, I mean, if there's, as an astrophysicist, a high energy astrophysicist, or a cosmologist, you're going to run into those times. But this is most phenomenal. But if you have to go, I mean, if you have to go back, you can just always go up here. And just go ahead and if you can figure out what your distribution function is, you figure out what the deviation, what's the velocity of all the particles, how the particles behave, how that's going to depend. Then you just go ahead and explicitly integrate for all the momentum of how the velocity of the velocities in two different directions behave. Oh, yeah. If you did it explicitly for an ideal glass, then yeah, you would end up with the same result in the end. But if you didn't have an ideal gas and you wanted to do the same thing, you could. I mean, you just start. You go back to here. This is the general. This is the general formula.
This expression is for ideal fluid, right? So
mm-hmm.
Not only for ideal gas.
Right. Yeah. Ideal fluids. Any fluids for which EV equals N, I'm just expressing the constant. So basically, EV equals N. Whenever that's true, then this will hold for local thermal equilibrium. Basically, if temperature is well defined, if you have a well defined temperature almost, and like radiation pressure is not dominating or something. So, like I mean, one of the a natural expansion of this is sort of like if pressure is like goes like temperature plus into the temperature to the fourth, which happens whenever you have a gas where it's mixed radiation and matter pressure, then yes, so this will no longer be of exactly this. But you can still do some work. Does that make sense? It's a good question. Any other questions? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. Very good. Yeah.
In your question over there, the energy tensor, the second part is the satellite, is it like and delta VI delta VJ, or is it delta VI VJ?
Oh, yeah. No, it's delta VI delta V. Sorry. I just forgot to switch notation completely. The point is that it's just it's just breaking apart the bulk flow from the random motion. And so there, so that's the whole thing. It's like in local thermal equilibrium, this is the well-defined thing to do. You have, you know, your fluid flowing along, still has a local pressure just determined by it. Right? And so then the tensor, the stress tensor of the acting on the fluid will be given by that bulk motion, like the behavior of that bulk motion, plus the random part. Does that make sense? Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, I'm presenting a tremendous amount of material today, so don't feel bad if it sort of seems a little overwhelming. It is. It's a lot of stuff. We have a class where we get through all of fluid mechanics in 2 weeks, and then move on to like whatever fluid mechanics, and then next thing you know, we'll be doing like general relativity, right? So, and then we're going to do cosmology, and it'll be easier on me when we get to cosmology. This I'm not quite as. I mean, I'm a little bit, but. This is a tremendously huge field, this fluid business. So next week, well, hopefully we'll actually have y'all present some problems next week. And Nia should be back. He's been away. I don't know if we ever said that. He's traveling. He needed to go visit his family, and there were no availability of flights for like previous month and a half. So he had to leave. So he feels about it. I was probably supposed to do this last week. Anyway, he'll be back next week, hopefully. This flight's supposed to arrive on Wednesday. We'll see if it actually gets here in time. I don't know. It's like 24 hours of travel. Those who have come from Iran can speak to the difficulty of traversing the Atlantic from the Mediterranean. Or you know, coming from Iran all the way over here to Canada. All right, so up till now, I've been telling you constantly that most of the time we're not going to worry about these dissipative processes. So this is actually not strictly true. So I guess, I mean, I haven't been meaning to lie to you, but I guess I have. Anyway, because this viscosity is actually probably the most important thing that we all know about fluids. And basically the nicest way, I think, to think about viscosity is just let's call it what robs fluid of its moment. What takes away where does the momentum of a fluid go if it doesn't stay in the fluid? It goes into what viscosity is what takes it away. And so, going back to this equation, we know that, so the conserving parts of Tij, we just derived, right? It's basically rho times di vj. I'm not going to be so careful about making sure these are capital anymore. But the pressure, these are all very good. And so in viscous flow, there comes one more term here. It's basically a viscosity tensor. And it turns out that it's often very convenient to write this as Tij, this is equal to rho dij minus sigma ij, where we define sigma ij equal to sigma tilde ij minus. So it's just, this is the difference between pressure and this viscosity, viscous stress, the so-called viscous stress. I'm going to say more about this viscous stress tensor momentarily, because it's, right now it's just some number, right? Some number with, or some matrix with 9 components, none of which we know. We're getting very close now to equations that actually govern real fluids. Everything we've had so far governs real fluids in ideal cases. And actually, both of them are important in astrophysics. I was going back and forth when I was thinking about how to present this. But in astrophysics, I think that cases are more ideal more often than in the real world. But I think that may just be because it's really, like, we don't know how to solve fluid equations. And so if we're having to solve fluid equations in the stars that are, you know, a gigaparsec away, try to make it as simple as possible. But I think it's most of the time it's a good approximation. Turns out we could reason from general principles about what kind of form this sigma, this stress tensor should have. Looks like a question mark. No. So basically the thing that we know is that, okay, so this is gonna be probably coming from you're probably all dead bored now. I'll let you talk. What kind of things happen in the fluid that would cause it to be what kind of a phenomenon do you think would cause friction? Transfer momentum. So what would that look like in terms of velocity? Yes, it's an interaction. It would be an interaction between particles. And so the particles are interacting with each other, and you have
some manner of longer range forces.
Not longer range. It's still short range.
Higher attraction between particles, maybe?
all of those things are true. I was looking for something more basic. So basically, if you look at so if you have like let me just think about we'll just think of pipe. This is a better way to think about it, right? And we generally know, and so like, and there's a lot of crud in the pipe here, right? So we're having the fluid flow through here, right? So if the water is moving, imagine it's moving faster in the middle or on the side?
Middle,
right? So velocity's I, like 100 here, and say it's equal to 10 here, right? So this is big, so this would be a velocity gradient, yes, exactly. So, and how would I write a velocity? I'd write it as a gradient of velocity, right? And so if it's a vector, so since we need a tensor, we're not going to take the divergence, we're going to take actually just the gradient of velocity, yeah. And so this is in fact sort of the heart of viscosity, is just that velocity, whenever velocities vary in space, then that's what allows friction to occur and for fluids. I mean, if we didn't have a viscous fluid, this couldn't happen, right? That the velocities were different. Because there's nothing that had come up previously that would allow this to occur. It's just and so it turns out, so this is going to be proportional to basically EVI DXJ. And then for symmetry, J, yeah, so just a symmetric combination of the gradient of the ith component of velocity and the jth direction, and then vice versa. And so basically now what we do is we just go ahead and write this out as generally as possible. And so we like, because it's like, parameters, so we just go ahead and call the first parameter this. And so what are the different things I can do this to this? Okay, I can just go ahead and do this one that I already have. Then this, I have more tricks up my sleeve, right? So I can go ahead and this is gonna be a little bit magical for a moment, but it'll seem very clear in a moment. So, and I'm going to subtract the, I'm going to go ahead and just go ahead and have, take the trace of this and multiply it by a delta function. And then I'm going to introduce one more term times EI. Okay. I'm not being careful with my raise and lowered indices at the moment. But, right, there's this case, and there's also this case. So those, both of those can occur. So this is a subset, right? And so basically, the reason I've broken it in this way is that if I go ahead and operate on, if I go ahead and take the trace of this, this will be, the trace of each of these is it'll be three. It'll be three times. It'll just be so the trace of this will be this, right? So delta ij acting on vi xj, right? Is just going to be that's the definition of this thing, right? So that's appearing here. So if we do this on both of these, we get. This, and then if we have this di delta ij going on to this delta ij, this is going to give vector 3 minus 2 over 3 times 3 times this again. 0. So this is the part. So basically this form has been chosen, the tensor vector has been chosen. So this part vanishes. If I take this trace, and this part doesn't. Okay. This is sort of the trace and the trace. This is like the trace free part. That's the trace part. Again, this is something that comes up a lot in physics. And now we have two undetermined components, eta and xi. And that's actually not xi, it's like theta, right? And last for lunch, last thing I'm going to do is derive the Navier-Stokes equation, basically plugging these equations straight into the old momentum conservation equation. So we go back to the equation that we started with. Right.
Whatever.
Anyway, and so then we're going to go ahead and rewrite this as minus pressure. So we have a pressure part. Then we'll have the bulk velocity flow part. And then, last but not least, we have you can keep yourselves awake by making sure that you get all these components, right? The stress tensor. And so if we assume that the density is not changing in time, and that eta and zeta are constants to the fluid, then this equation becomes a very famous, a very important Navier-Stokes equation. We had switching back to vector notation because I'm done. I really see that this term that I've been looking at here actually comes back and looks just like a blue term we were talking about, right? So we have the Dahlenberg acting on V, and then the gradient of the divergence of V. Right. So this governs every fluid you've ever known. And it's completely impossible to solve. So the famous problems of turbulence all appear just from the solution. So this equation, if you master this equation, fame and fortune lie before you, because ancient, still not exhausted. One of the founders of quantum mechanics, was it Heisenberg, who said that the if you got to heaven and you wanted to ask God the explanation of quantum mechanics and of the turbulent flow of fluids and for quantum mechanics, he was hoping for a good answer. Turbulence. The point is that you can get turbulent from just considering these equations. And one of the homework problems talks about a little bit. I hope it's not going to be too much. But the point is that this equation that looks kind of innocuous is a real bear. Okay, so that is the Navier-Stokes equation. And just before I let you go for lunch, I just want to say that, again, I told you that whenever you have divergence of V was zero, that's called an incompressible fluid. And that means that, and it simplifies things actually quite a lot. You see, you lose this kind of ugly term you have. Schellenberg V, gradient of pressure, and then just velocity flow. Makes things a lot simpler. And in that case, also, this viscous stress tensor takes a simpler form. It's just basically the cross, the these things go away, and it's just you end up with. So that's actually a really important case. And it means that this coefficient is more important than this other one. And so, in fact, that coefficient is called the dynamic viscosity. So if you talk about a fluid having viscosity, it's because it has this coefficient not equal to zero. And then there's another variable that's often defined called the kinematic viscosity. Just basically this just divides up density. Obviously, I mean, where the names come from, this one's weighted by, sort of in some sense weighted by the density, and take the density out, it's just like kinematics versus dynamics. And so just, if you're curious, like eta for water is about 0.01 grams per centimeter per second. For nitrogen gas, that is the air, it's about 1.8 times 10 to the minus 4. So quite small. That's why air is less viscous than water. And for alcohol, remember this formula for all of a sudden, it's about the same as water, but a little bit more viscous. 0.08. And so, I mean, I'm just writing out these numbers to show you that, like in this equation, everything sort of like these are order one. And then for things that aren't that viscous, like water, this is this term, which is the one that causes the problems, is down by two orders of magnitude. For air, it's down by four orders of magnitude. And yet, that's big enough to get turbulent flow, because we all know that water can flow turbulently. And so it's just even a little, some relatively small perturbation here is enough. Make us impotent before the in the face of the physical world. Okay, so any more questions before lunch? Yeah. Why are they different? It turns out that it's useful to write it that way. It's just that the point is that this is the traceless and trace part, and so. It turns out that you can generally have two different coefficients.
Why partial v I partial x j and partial v j and partial x I have different?
Why don't they have different?
Yeah.
So I guess I think the fluid would be some kind of it would have some kind of weird asymmetry if that were true. If you could just, because you switch, you'd be able to switch between the two. I mean, switch direction, like rotational. Yeah, rotational. So this is called. I mean, I think this is generally called shear. What? Right, this is bulk. And bulk viscosity and shear viscosity. And so bulk viscosity is zero on the root, incompressible. Shear viscosity, which doesn't change the volume, is the off diagonal part. Any other questions? Much higher, yeah. Yeah, because it didn't. Very good. Even though eta is smaller, it'd be very much higher. Other questions? Yeah, great. If you want to take your problem set to look at over your lunch, you may. When we get back from this, we should want to start at 12:45. And then I'm just going to introduce sound waves and sound speed after lunch, and then you can all go home and I'll be done talking to you. Okay, thanks.